Hello and welcome to the Shepherd Walwyn podcast series. My name is Jonathan Brown. Shepherd Walwyn is a campaigning book publisher based in London, England. Our purpose is to uncover and promote new ideas to society's oldest problems. And whilst our specialty is ethical economics, something Anthony Werner, our driving force for over 40 years, has pioneered, we have branched out over the years to other related areas such as the environment and the lives and works of society's change agents. These podcasts promote ideas we're convinced can actually help us build a better society for all of us. So have a listen and be sure to share with your friends if you like them, but also tell us what you think. These are debates we all need to be part of. So without further ado, let's get into the interview. Welcome back to part two of my interview with Phil Allen, the author of The New School of Economics. Now by day, Phil is a top software engineer, helping companies spot and solve problems. But like all great superheroes, and also interesting people, he has a second role, that of a top economic policy analyst. And his new book marries both of these skill sets together. He demonstrates a broad view essential for someone committed to solving solutions to seemingly intractable social and economic problems, but he also shows a pragmatic engineering mindset essential for ensuring his ideas pass his own quality control standards. Now, whilst Phil is a native of Canada, he's currently living and working in Asia, and I recently caught up with him just ahead of his book launch to ask him about the ideas in his book. So, Phil, one of the things that obviously, I mean, your book contains an extraordinary number of ideas and practical suggestions for changing things. I just wondered if we could start with why do we have such an unfair system at the moment?
Right. Well, I think it's a problem of incentives, actually. I mean, money and resources are a little bit like a fast flowing river. You can, it's kind of a neutral entity that goes to where it's guided more or less, or goes to where it most freely goes. And I think that's a kind of analogous to our system of taxation and incentives that we have, even the regulatory environment. And I think now we have a system in a lot of countries, especially Western countries. I think other countries might have a slightly different set of problems from the same origin. But there are many countries that have an issue where resources are flowing into non-productive areas, primarily land, and also other areas of rent seeking. So basically, whereas you might desire from a when it comes to policy outcomes and what you want out of a country and what you want out of a society and what you want out of an economic system, primarily you would want a lot of resources to accrue to investment and income. Whereas often we're finding that a lot of the cash is flowing more towards land speculation, which people are calling real estate, but really it's land in actuality, and areas of rent seeking, such as companies that might have a monopoly over a specific resource or over a specific patent. So a lot of investment in cash is accruing to these sorts of areas, whereas productive investment is being starved. And I think we're seeing that when we see, for example, in the US and the UK, for example, current account imbalances, where especially trade imbalances, where the countries are importing a lot more than they're exporting, real estate bubbles, very volatile economies that have pretty serious crashes when a real estate bubble busts, and things of that nature. So, you know, I think the issue is one of resource misallocation.
And what's your take on how this has come about?
Well, I think good policy is not always good politics. In fact, frequently they're opposing. And bad policy is sometimes great politics. And you know, in any system, including a democracy, you know, you have to appeal to some group of the population, and a democracy is a it's a wider group. And unfortunately, to make long-term lasting changes, you might need to make some unpopular decisions that are a difficult sell to the public, and vice versa. Sometimes the quick band-aid fix is the popular solution. So I think it's really a matter of human nature to some extent. And I believe that without adequate education on the topic of policy making, people might be susceptible to just going for the quick fix rather than the long-term solution.
And yet, and so you've spent, I mean, part time, admittedly, but you're devoting a considerable amount of time to changing this system. So what is it that convinces you that this isn't inevitable?
Right. So I think you know, we in the context of unfairness more generally, I think there's always going to be a degree of unfairness, and not always necessarily in a bad way. I mean, we're all born with our own advantages and disadvantages and our own handicaps and our own strengths. And I don't think that in itself is a bad thing. But I think we're really, you know, shooting ourselves in the foot by putting up unnecessary obstacles and barriers to our own success. I think that ultimately the you know, people left to their own devices make good decisions for themselves and their families, generally, of course. But we're putting barriers in the way and obstacles to getting to where we want to be. For example, that could be in something like you know, privatizing land rents, or it could be something like occupational licensing, or it could, you know, we're putting barriers in the way of doing things that we want to do, and we don't even realize that we kind of sleepwalk into that. So I think that part is a matter of just education on the topic, and people being aware that there are solutions out there.
And so any other, I know you talked about incentives. Are there any other distortions or externalities that you see in the current economic system that are causing the most pain and distortion for people?
Right. So I think, like I was saying, I believe that the tax system is kind of one place that we can look most immediately. For example, we have a heavy reliance in many countries on income taxation, and income tax is something that depends on a workforce. But we actually have in a lot of countries, including here in Thailand. Including in some of the neighbors here in Asia, including in the West, there's a shrinking labor force. So we're putting a greater and greater burden of taxation on a shrinking resource, which is labor. Also, for example, we're taxing more generally labor as a part of productive activity. But also small business, whereas we're not placing as big of a burden on land and consumption in most countries, as well as, yeah, I think areas such as occupational licensing, banking licenses, intellectual property law, zoning, and other license monopolies, but especially land, we're unwittingly granting certain seg very, very small and lucky segments of the population, monopolies or oligopolies over certain areas of you know, a country's wealth. And this is creating a distortion where it's basically providing them with a disproportionate amount of a country's resources, financial resources.
So, Phil, the book is the subtitle, whilst it's called The New School of Economics, you're actually suggesting that taking us back to a group of people called the physiocrats, because what your subtitle is The Platform and Theory Behind the New Physiocrats. So I wonder, I think some of our readers will know and have studied the physiocrats, but just for those who haven't, could you tell us who the physiocrats were and what were their key ideas?
Right. So basically, they were a group of 18th century French economists. They weren't even the idea of an economist didn't exist at that time. So they were both proto-economists and proto-Georgists, I'd describe them as. And they were opposed to the school of economic thought. And again, I use the term loosely because economics was not really it was not really a school at the time. It was very early on in its development. But at that time, the school of economic thought was mercantilism, and it was the idea that a country should be exporting more than it's importing, basically running a trade surplus in order to accumulate as much gold as it possibly could. That's I'm simplifying it a lot, but that's more or less the basics. And the physiocrats were in favor of free trade, and they saw that that land in particular was whereas other schools of thought that maybe hoarding gold was the main source of a country's wealth, the physiocrats saw more that land had some key properties that made it a something unique and something as like the main source of a country's wealth. So they weren't right on the money with everything, but basically their ideas behind land were certainly on to something. And they were the first also to propose this idea of a land value tax, more or less. It was basically a landowner's fee as the source of government income, whereas other countries were focused more on tariffs and trade restrictions. So this was where they broke apart from the mainstream school of thought at the time. And so again, this was very, very early on. The ideas were not as highly developed, but this was sort of a precursor to Georgism. Now, I believe Georgism, which was named after the economist Henry George in the U.S., I don't believe he ever really credited the physiocrats with his ideas, because I think he came to those conclusions independently. But nevertheless, his ideas were much more developed, especially being about 100 years later. But yeah, the physiocrats were kind of the first to kind of latch on to this idea that land or geographical coordinates were something of particular value to an economy. And so they were sort of foundational. And I give some credit to them for being the first. They might not have been the first, but the first recorded group to come to these conclusions.
I know some of our readers, when they've read the work of Michael Hudson and his philosophy of a fairer society, I know some of the ideas around how to maintain fairness in an economy have been occupying people's minds for thousands of years. But by some strange coincidence, the powers that be, often those who own the land, are quite happy for those ideas not to get explored, or the idea of debt cancellations to be remembered. And it's another thing, isn't it? So you work with a group of people called the New Physiocrats. So who are they, and what's their background?
So that was actually something founded by myself, in fact. So more or less, I wanted to create a comprehensive political and economic platform. And actually, I do credit the Georgist community with expanding on some of these original ideas that were built off this idea of the land value tax. But I also didn't want to overshadow their name, or to be claiming to represent all Georgists. And so I wouldn't have wanted to call it, for example, the new Georgist and speak on everybody else's behalf. I wanted to create something that maybe some of the Georgists would even disagree with, but it would be kind of a branch of the Georgist community, and focused also a lot more on a practical, implementable platform with concrete policy ideas, and something more of an action-related organization. And basically, I created this this platform, which is also a work in progress. I'm always collecting feedback and adjusting and playing with some of the ideas a little bit more and developing them further. And but basically, it's an avenue to, first of all, reach out to political parties in other in around the world that might be interested in such policy ideas, interacting with them, hosting Q&A sessions on my subreddit. And with this, we accumulated about 500 members on Reddit. And so we have a couple of other moderators on there. And yeah, it's actually kind of blossomed to a small and growing little community. But yeah, I do credit the Georgist community for helping to support that. And I consider it kind of an action-oriented arm of the community.
And I think that one of the things that you do, and I think that the Georgists have been around for so long now, they can very easily get pigeonholed as a single taxes, right? And as if that's the only thing that was about. And when you look at your work, there's a whole lot more around economic, social, political reforms of how to run a fairer society. And if the society or community was to get the rewards that are currently going into land speculation, and that came into the group, then this is what you could do with it. And I think some of your ideas there are they go much further than a lot of the Georgist arguments. And I think I also like as well the way in which if you go back to the physiocrats, then you automatically draw in, or you're only just a short step away from the classical economist, Adam Smith being the most famous, who was inspired by the physiocrats, right?
Right. And I think that also, the single taxer idea, while it is in a way the fundamental idea that this was initially built on, it's not enough for a political platform, in my opinion. I mean, typically political platforms include a social element, a political element, and an economic element, and also address topical and current discussions of the time. And so I think being a one issue, if a party were to implement Georgist ideas, they would also be looking for some overlap in other in the social and political realm. And so I think just being a single taxer on its own, it's not adequate for for the basis of a party. And so I want to provide something a little more comprehensive as well. The Georgist idea from Henry George is already quite old, and we want to be certain that it's covering some of the aspects of modern life that might not have been covered more than a century or two ago.
Brilliant. So how do your economic thoughts and ideas differ from the prevailing view, which I guess we could classify as neoclassical economics, would you say?
Right. Yeah. So basically, I think the key difference is that in neoclassical economics, which is a good distinction that you made versus classical economics, is the lumping together of capital and land under the category of capital. And yeah, basically, I think that it's not. The distinction that I'd like to make is that idea is not true, and it never has been. Land has always been a distinct factor of production from capital. It's a necessary input, in almost all cases, but it does have completely separate properties from capital, primarily in the fact that it does not the supply it does not respond to a change in price. The supply of geographical locations is fixed, and I think that's where that's basically the what the physiocrats in their original form discovered.
So in your mind then, what makes a prosperous economy?
So a prosperous economy is, first of all, I think that a prosperous economy means prosperous people, prosperous individuals, maybe prosperous families. And I think people know how to make themselves prosper if they're just given the most basic tools. I think people know how to grow themselves financially and in turn grow the economy. So I don't think that people need much help. I think it's more about getting some of these barriers out of the way. For example, land is the biggest barrier of them all, in that land is a necessary factor of production. It's a necessary input, but it's monopolized, and it's monopolized out of choice, out of policy decisions. So, if we're just giving individuals the basic resources they need, access to land and financial capital, I think the prosperous economy comes with that.
And that, what would you say were some of the key ideas in your book? For example, you talk about the three pillars.
Right. So basically, so these three pillars would be like a national dividend, a national income supplement, and an assisted savings program. So the idea of a national dividend, some people might equate it to a universal basic income, which is a fixed payment every month or every whatever period to all individuals in a particular country. A national dividend would differ from that by being more based on the revenue raised. So it would be fiscally neutral, and it would be giving people a share in the pie. So in the case of what the new physiocrats propose, that would be a share in consumption tax revenue, which in itself is controversial in the Georgist community, but basically it's giving people a share in the pie, and it would be paid out every periodically, so every month, for example. So that would be the national dividend. That kind of provides a shareholding in the economy's wealth, and it would likely not be particularly large, but it would give a kind of safety net that would be more efficient than a complex web of bureaucratic programs that might be of mixed effectiveness. So it would be a cash handout. The next pillar is the national income supplement, which would be effectively a wage subsidy. And again, this would serve two functions. It would provide an additional form of safety net for workers. It would be effectively a negative rate of taxation on their income, and as well, it would prevent people from too haphazardly leaving the labor market right away in the event of them receiving a national dividend by subsidizing their labor. And it would be effectively a redirection of resources from consumption into production. And this is another theme in the book of creating a more production-oriented economy rather than a consumption-oriented one. And finally, the third pillar would be the assisted savings program, which is an alternative to the current system. So, for example, in most countries that have a system of social security for the elderly, it's based on a growing a demographic pyramid that looks more or less inverse to what we have now. So basically a younger population supporting an older population, which is proving to be somewhat unsustainable in aging countries where there are fewer and fewer working people supporting more and more retirees. And this would be a system instead that would promote long-term and subsidized savings in individual accounts that would be topped up through a small tax on capital gains. So it would effectively be a subsidy on long-term savings and investment. So again, that would serve as a form of security for retirees and for long-term savers, as well as once again, rerouting resources towards savings and production and a little bit more away from consumption and land.
And that's really the fundamental tenet of your ideas, right? Is to move away from rent seeking behaviors and a focus on land speculation or property speculation, as it would be commonly known, and moving it towards encouraging and promoting production and versus consumption.
That's exactly right. I think that we see the results of the opposite a lot now in for example, Canada, the US, the UK, where there is a great incentive to consume disproportionately in a way that seems divergent from what you would expect in a market economy with a floating exchange rate, where a country is running a large and growing sometimes trade deficit, current account deficit, with heavy borrowing and fiscal deficits as well. And so basically, and effectively, that's describing overconsumption. And then a lot of the growth is happening in areas of real estate prices. So it just seems that the current system that we have in a lot of countries is just a misallocation of resources, and it seems contrary to what one might expect in a functioning market.
Yeah, that's a very polite way of describing it, Phil. Yeah, it doesn't quite make sense. My take on the physiocrats and also the classical economics is you leave people alone as much as possible, and create an environment for people to act appropriately in a way that benefits themselves and the community. And yet you make some really, really very detailed recommendations. And one of the things I mentioned in the email was the one about the getting married and waiting 22 months. And I'm just wondering what's the thinking behind making it so nuanced.
So basically, it was twofold. One was I was kind of prompted to address ideas outside of the economics realm, and as well as and kind of move it a little bit into the conversation of the social and political realm, because I think that's what makes a political platform. So if political parties would be adopting this platform, whether in pieces or in its entirety, I did want to address some things on the social side. And I was seeing marriage licenses somewhat akin to occupational licensing and other forms of licensing that create rent seeking in the economy. And I was looking for a way to make it a little bit more flexible and not so top down, and just to add a little bit more flexibility into the idea. Actually, since writing the book, I would even open my mind a little bit further, and would suggest that maybe some private institutions might be able to have some basically to remove the state monopoly over marriage, and maybe try opening the floodgates a little bit to see if other types of marriage contracts could come out of a more creative or dynamic part of the social contracts. And yeah, so basically I was toying with this idea to make it less things a little bit less rigid, and I came to those conclusions in the book. But like I said, since writing the book, I would even be open to experimenting a little bit more with that and seeing what kind of contracts could come out of private institutions, for instance, with regards to marriage.
What an amazing idea. That's blown my mind, Phil. That's I had no idea that marriage is a state monopoly. It's a license, and so it's a state monopoly. So that needs to we need to be op more open to new ideas around that, right?
Well, I think when we're facing a demographic crisis with regards to low birth rates, it would be interesting to see what and also I marriage was not always a state monopoly. In the past, it was done by religious institutions, but I would be interested to see what the wider public would come up with from with a slight opening of the marriage licensing.
Well, fascinating chain of thought.
And it's something I see actually, being here in Thailand has opened my eyes to some of these things. Like, for example, here with regards to, first of all, with business and commerce, the regulatory environment is not enforced until the business gets to a certain size. And again, I'm not advocating necessarily for this, but it's just an observation. Where you see a lot of there's a large informal sector, a large gray sector of the Thai economy, and you see the kinds of interesting things that come out of that. Whether it's the unregulated street food or just kind of events that might just pop up that would ordinarily be banned in other places, different types of weird racing and types of vehicles and things that wouldn't be allowed on a road in normal places. But that also expands here to the institution of marriage. And so you see people getting married informally just through their Buddhist temple, but maybe not having an official state marriage. And yeah, I don't know. It's like it's kind of being abroad has kind of allowed me to capture and see some of these different ways of operating. So I feel like my earlier, childhood worldview has kind of shattered over the years.
No, I think it's because I spent quite a bit of time in Japan, and that first experience of being there, the culture shock of seeing such different things and thinking these guys are crazy, why do they do it? That's wrong. And then come back and think, hang on a second, not only am I seeing, so for example, seeing the much more commercially minded and some of the manipulation that goes on for in Japan, you have festivals for everything, right? You have Kids' Day, Grandparents' Day, the Taxi Driver Day, and you got two Valentine's days, and I'm thinking you guys are, you're just so manipulated. And then I came back and I thought, hang on a second, we're just as manipulated. I just didn't see my manipulation. I can see everyone else's in Japan, but when I came home, it was like, oh, okay, maybe we're not quite so free. We just pretend that we are. And no, fascinating, fascinating. There's a few countries that you mentioned through the book, and Taiwan and Estonia are two of the ones that you mentioned most. What is it that they're doing that's comparable to your recommendations?
So I think they're both very interesting and quite different cases. So Estonia, they had a after the fall of communism in the I don't remember if he was the first leader of the country or the second, but it was a very technocratic leadership that they had, and they had a way of kind of simplifying their tax code and introducing a land value tax as part of that, and also digitizing their a lot of their bureaucracy and civil service to create a very streamlined system that created better incentives that were both market oriented but as well providing a safety net and becoming relatively streamlined as well. And this is something that I feel could only have happened after such a crisis as the collapse of their entire economic system, like much of the former Soviet Union had in their late 80s, early 90s. And yeah, so out of that blossomed this kind of enlightened technocratic leadership that implemented sound policies. And Estonia was worth a mention in the book because of their land value tax in particular. And they've been a, you know, they were one of the Baltic Tigers, one of the big post-Soviet success stories. They're also a small country, which can make things a little easier to implement such policies. Taiwan had actual different roots, more philosophical roots, where the leadership there actually were well read in the school of Henry George and Georgism, and they were less technocrats and more on the philosophical end of things. And in Taiwan, they implemented a serious land reform and a land value tax, and they all also became one of the Asian tigers. So yeah, and basically they also had a very pro-production mentality when it came to policymaking, and they became one of the great manufacturers of the world, a lot bigger than Estonia in terms of population, basically 1 million versus 22 million, I believe. Yeah, also a great example, at least in their early years of Georgist inspired policy. And both countries are turned out to be to turned out to develop into great success stories economically. They have probably strayed somewhat, both of them, from their original ideas, but at least the roots and the founding of those countries as independent nations, Taiwan being unrecognized by some, but those roots did produce economic success, and I think they make great examples.
And so when I read your book, there's a lot of ideas in there that look to me to be really good ones and compelling. I just wondered that what thought you've given to the transition. So let's just say if a population did start to wake up and had a level of insight into what could be possible, and to notice and to see the perversity of the incentives, perversity in terms of in economic terms rather than in moral terms. What could a country or a group start to do to move towards the new physiocratic system?
Right. So I think that first of all, it depends on you know where you're living and the political situation there. In some countries, this might be more challenging; in other countries, less. In some ways, it can start on a local level, and I think that would be the most maybe not as rewarding as a start, or not even as interesting or revolutionary, but maybe the most feasible. And there's a lot of a lot more talk in the past 6 months, especially about some of these ideas being implemented on a local level. For example, replacing a property tax with a land value tax. Now, this can be done in a revenue neutral way. So, for those who are unfamiliar with this concept, a property tax is taxing both the land, the underlying land, and the structure. So, for example, the land and the house, or the land and the building, and or the land and the office, or the land and the farm. Whereas a land value tax only taxes just the underlying land, which is more in line with the Georgist idea. So I think just getting, for example, the concept of a land value tax into the hearts and minds of a population is a first step. So at a local level, if for someone who is living in a place fortunate enough to elect their local mayor or their local you know town or city council, whoever it may be, there are candidates that are gaining ground that do advocate for this kind of switch between a property tax and a land value tax. And I think that would be a good initial first step. On the national level, I think there are fewer parties that are bold enough to go for that change. Although there are some, for example, there's one party in New Zealand that I believe is quite new that are advocating for a transition away from some of the bottom brackets of income tax towards a land value tax instead. Yeah, I think on whatever level of government that you could take action, I think the polls are a good way to do that. From my home city of Toronto, there was one mayoral candidate a few months back who was running on a campaign that had a land value tax at its core, and she was invited on our subreddit for to do a Q&A session, and I don't know if we can take any credit for it, but she did came, I believe, in third place in the Toronto election. So I think some of these ideas are starting to percolate a little bit. And I think the most painless way to make the first initial step or transition could be at the local level where some of these candidates might have a fighting chance.
So in many respects, it's almost like the legalization of marijuana in various countries is that the legislation often came in at a local level, and then people figured out a way collectively to make it work and to deal with any possible negative side effects.
Right. Yeah, I think there's a lot more room for experimentation in smaller geographic areas, whether it's a local community, a town, or a city, or even a small country. I think that's actually one of the reasons why, a place like Estonia was able to introduce such comprehensive and drastic and even somewhat experimental reforms, because of their size. The risk tolerance seems to be higher on a local level. And yeah, as you said, I think that with, for example, the legalization of marijuana, people want to wait and see maybe till the neighbors experimented with such policies, and then also the it becomes part of your normal vocabulary, some idea like a land value tax, and then these kind of start to spread like wildfire over the course of a few years. Yeah, I mean, as much as I would love for something to be implemented on a national level, which is something I'm also trying to experiment with, and trying to get these ideas out there. I think realistically, we have to celebrate our small victories as well.
Phil, are there any things you'd like to say to the listeners before we wrap up our conversation? Any other ideas you'd like to share before we go?
I just want to reiterate the fact that, yeah, in addition to this being an issue of fairness and a means of us all becoming part of a fairer and more fulfilling system, it's also part of this idea of practicality and what being realistic and not entirely ideological. In every possible sphere, sometimes we have to look at the reality of the situation and implement policy proposals that might be addressing specific issues, time specific issues, or location specific issues that might not always be covered by the more philosophical end of our community. And this is something that I'm trying to introduce with some of these policies. So yeah, basically, practicality, I think, is the way forward for us. Being a little bit flexible and open to new proposals, I think is key to our success.
No, I think there's so many really, really interesting and what seems to be practical and useful ideas in your book. So, thank you very much for your time. We really appreciate your the work and giving us the interview today.
Thank you. It's been great.
Thank you for listening to the Shepherd Walwyn podcast. To explore these ideas further, be sure to visit our website www.shepherdwalwyn.com and join our mailing list for news and special offers. Check out our authors and buy the books to learn more. And you can also find us on social media. Links are also on the website. And if you like the podcast, please head over to iTunes or Spotify to give us a review. It's surprisingly helpful in getting the ideas out there. So until next time, keep reading.